Thanks to everyone here and for listening, who's listening over the phone. We're very glad that we also have so many of the authors here with us today. Just as a quick reminder, the information in this press conference is embargoed until 2 p.m. today. That includes any tweeting, so we will wait. If we could wait for those tweets to get out till after 2, that would be great. So my name is Nick Wigginton. I'm at Science Magazine. I'd just like to briefly provide some general background as to why Science is excited about publishing the paper today. As we know, the Deepwater Horizon blowout has resulted in one of the worst environmental disasters in recent times, and has already economically affected millions of people in the Gulf region. The release of such a large quantity of oil will also likely have detrimental consequences to fisheries and other marine life, but those effects are not well understood. One of the first steps towards understanding the ecological impacts of this event is characterizing what happened to the oil at depth in the Gulf. The authors of this paper have taken an innovative approach to identifying and sampling part of a deep hydrocarbon plume, including measuring critical oxygen levels. These levels are obviously important biologically, but also reveal the extent that microorganisms may have contributed to the natural degradation of the oil. Science is excited to publish this paper because these data are not only important benchmarks for this particular spill, but for all future spills. More broadly, the paper contributes to our understanding of the biological and chemical dynamics of the oceans, a topic whose global importance is often overlooked. Next is David Conover at the National Science Foundation.
Thank you. The mission of the National Science Foundation is to promote the progress of science and thereby advance the health, prosperity, and welfare of our nation. To advance the frontiers of knowledge, we make strategic investments in advanced instrumentation and facilities, and we support excellence in science and engineering research through education and grants awarded to independent scientists and their institutions. The discoveries reported today illustrate the importance of NSF's mission. Long-term investment in state-of-the-art instrumentation like Sentry and the other instruments you're going to hear about during this conference has not only helped to advance basic knowledge, but now has become valuable in a case of national emergency. The research you're going to hear about also underscores the value of NSF's Rapid Award Program, which, within a matter of days, provides funds to enable scientists to quickly arrive on the scene and begin rigorous study of episodic events, such as this oil spill. In fact, to date, the National Science Foundation has issued a total of 90 rapid grant awards to investigators totaling more than $10 million for a study of the Gulf oil spill alone, and we've invested an additional $3 million in ship-related operating costs. The payoff for this investment occurs when peer-reviewed results like these reported today are made public, and we look forward to many additional NSF-supported discoveries coming forward in the weeks and months ahead. And with that, I'd like to introduce Rob Munier, who is a vice president at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute.
Thank you, David. Rob Munier, Woods Hole Oceanographic. I'm vice president there. I also serve as coordinator for our response to the Deepwater Horizon spill. On behalf of President and Director Susan Avery of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, thank you very much for coming. And for those of you on the phone, thank you for listening in. Woods Hole is a research institution with expertise that spans the oceanographic sciences, including over four decades of work on oil spills. We also have a very strong engineering capability, as evidenced by our well-known expertise in deep submergence, both manned and unmanned, as well as a variety of other tools that enable science in the sea and the subsequent analysis of data collected. Our main resource is our staff of scientists, engineers, and technicians. We approach any scientific question with prudence and thoroughness, with the primary objective of finding answers to the extent the analysis is supported by the data. Today, we're pleased to announce the results of work to identify and map a plume from the Deepwater Horizon spill by an interdisciplinary team of scientists from Woods Hole, led by Chief Scientist Dr. Rich Camilli and Principal Investigators Drs. Chris Reddy, Danny Yerger, and Ben Van Moy, and Associate Scientist Dr. James Kinsey. All are here today. This work incorporates the Woods Hole strengths of strong science enabled by expertise and innovative engineering. While this work was performed with urgency, we have been careful and deliberate. Added to the typical risks of working aboard an oceanographic research vessel were the hazards of the Deepwater Horizon site, which required specialized safety training and equipment. This work was performed under three grants from the National Science Foundation through their RAPIDS program, and we appreciate the important role NSF is playing in supporting basic research related to the Deepwater Horizon event. We also acknowledge NOAA and their role in coordinating the handling of samples taken during the cruise so that they meet the legal requirements of the National Resource Damage Assessment. Operationally, the cruise was coordinated with Unified Command, and we appreciate their support while in the vicinity of the blowout site. Our work was performed from the research vessel Endeavour, which is owned by NSF and operated by the University of Rhode Island. We greatly appreciate the work of the captain and crew of the Endeavour. In addition to the scientific team and ship's crew, there were observers from EPA, NOAA, and BP, and we appreciate their assistance. The value of the capabilities of a private institution like Woods Hole, working collaboratively with the federal government and other institutions, is well documented in this project. We're very proud of the work of Rich, Chris, Dana, Ben, and James, and the rest of the Woods Hole team. Their results provide some specific answers to questions about the characteristics of the plume. Their work raises other questions, and there is more data to be analyzed. The location, depth, flow, and duration make this spill like no other. Clearly, more work needs to be done. Thank you very much, and I'd like to introduce Rich Camilli, who is going to sort of begin the presentation.
Okay, can everybody hear me? Great. I'd like to start by saying that this project, as was described, occurred through a NSF-funded RAPID, three NSF-funded RAPID programs. The work on site occurred from June 19th to June 28th. 2010, and one of the interesting things as a scientist is the speed at which we mobilized for this. From the time that we first proposed the work to the time that NSF gave us the green light was approximately 2 days, and we were on board the ship within 2 weeks. That's lightning speed for research. As it would be for any response down there. So what we were attempting to do is identify if subsurface hydrocarbon plumes existed and try and characterize those to the fullest extent that we could. Now, the title slide here gives a little a kind of overview of what we found and I don't know how easy this is. I can show here, if you can see that cursor arrow there. What we found was a plume advecting to the southwest at about 1,100 meters depth, and this plume containing hydrocarbons. What we will describe today is, first of all, a little bit about this plume. The evidence that we've collected shows conclusively that a plume existed at that depth. Furthermore, the chemistry that we analyzed of the plume shows fairly clearly that this plume was created by the Macondo well site or the Deepwater Horizon well. It was not created by naturally occurring seeps. Furthermore, with this work, we were able to describe the spatial extent of the plume. One of the interesting characteristics of this plume is that it was stable at approximately 1,100 meters water depth. And that's something that's a little bit unexpected. And we don't have any clear indication as to why it's set up at that depth. Is something that should be investigated further. In addition, we were able to describe the flow rate, the rate of movement of this plume to the southwest, obviously we were able to describe, at least in the near field, the direction that it was headed. Now, we do not yet have a bulk flow estimate of this plume. And the reason for that is we've looked at some very specific hydrocarbons that are components of crude oil, but we have not yet completed the analysis for all of the composition of the oil. And my colleague, Dr. Reddy will describe a little bit more about that. Furthermore, we do not know what the fate of this plume now is. This was a forensic snapshot back in late June, and we have not been back there since, I believe it was June 28th or 29th. So, furthermore, without this complete picture of all of the components of the hydrocarbons, we can't say much about its bioactivity or toxicity. So, now the question you may have is, how did we go about our research program? We used some technologies that are fairly standard in oceanography. This here is a photograph of a CTD rosette, and it has on it water bottle samplers that are used to collect water from a specific depth interval, and so that you can bring those water samples back on deck and analyze them off-site, ex situ. In addition to this sort of standard technology, we had a mass spectrometer on board, and you can see where that cursor is. That's a Tethys mass spectrometer. That's work that I've been involved in for many years. And these mass spectrometers allow you to directly measure hydrocarbons in situ, within the water, submerged, so that we can say directly whether a hydrocarbon, a particular type of molecule or hydrocarbon is present, and then have some estimate as to how much of that particular kind of hydrocarbon is there. It allows a partial fingerprint of the molecules within the water, and in the upper right panel, you see there that it provides this spectrum type fingerprint where you can identify individual types of molecules. Now, another kind of technology that we used, and I should actually back up right there. This rosette, you can think of that as the gatherer. That's the way you gather the samples to do the NRDA type analyses, and that's the traditional method. We also used a reconnaissance capability with the mass spectrometer, and that was the Sentry autonomous underwater vehicle. Many people have seen on the news the remotely operated vehicles that are were used to help cap the well. This is the next generation after that. The autonomous vehicles are free swimming. They control themselves. And in this case, this system, which was developed through funding from the National Science Foundation, actually was used as a forward reconnaissance tool. We had this AUV run missions where it went in front of the ship in order to find areas of anomalously high hydrocarbons. And it actually had one of these mass spectrometers on, and I should also point out that the mass spectrometer was funded through a National Ocean Partnership Program grant. And among, it's a consortium of, I think, 15 federal agencies, and again, dedicated to developing technology and basic research. So we can move on to the next slide. The way that the AUV worked in this case was it was sent out on a mission, and it was, in this case, made to swim sort of zigzag patterns at a constant depth once we had identified the layer at which the hydrocarbons appeared to be present. And based on that, it was able to generate a data set that allowed us to track the plume and identify its spatial width and the length, moving out actually 35 kilometers out from the well site. Now, we used that data from the mass spectrometer to identify the chemical plume. But in addition, we used some of the vehicle's other sensors to identify the flow of the water itself, the velocity of the water in terms of its speed and direction. And what you see here is a plot showing where the crossings, where the vehicle crossed the plume, and the colors just are chosen to so that you can make sense of the different plume crossings. But the arrows are show velocity vectors of the water itself. So one of the interesting things is that the water velocity fairly clearly tracks with the plume, showing that the plume was advecting to the southwest there. And hopefully my colleague, Dr. Kinsey, will be able to field any questions about this work. And I should also point out that the AUV is the brainchild of Dr. Yerger, who's been developing robots since I was in diapers. So,
that's like 5 years ago.
Yeah, pretty much. But we were able to. I think this microphone is turned on. Okay. So we were able to take this data from the mass spectrometers from the CTD cast and the AUV and construct this map that you see here. And what this shows is the blue lines with the different coloration describes the hydrocarbons that it encountered. The background is the bathymetry of the seafloor there. And what you can see is how this plume curves around. It's what we call topographically controlled. It suggests that this plume is staying at a constant depth and just following the contour of the continental slope there. And we tracked this, like I said, out to 35 kilometers before we had to break off operations because of Hurricane Alex, and the Coast Guard required that all non-essential ships leave the area. So unfortunately, we were not able to track it any further than 35 kilometers, although the data suggests that this plume extended for much further than we tracked it. So I think the next slide, just to give you a kind of an introduction as to how we've been able to integrate these data sets. We've taken if you look at the upper right panel here, this shows the concentration profile as measured using the CTD rosette, where these were actual physical water samples that were taken. And in this case, an analysis was done on the samples looking for some very specific hydrocarbons. And you can see a very clear profile of a concentration gradient there. And consider that to be the z-axis, the vertical axis. And then in the y-axis, we used the mass spectrometer operating on the Sentry AUV in order to define the horizontal chemical gradient. That's what you see in the lower right panel. And by putting those two together, integrating those two, we were able to come up with a concentration distribution for a cross-section in this plume. And then by integrating that data with the velocity data of the plume, we were able to estimate the input rate of these particular types of hydrocarbons. And with that, I should turn it over to my colleague Chris Reddy, and you can pick up and describe more of the chemistry.
No, my name is Chris Reddy, and thank you for coming today. What Dr. Camilli just showed you in the upper right-hand panel were samples that were collected in collaboration with NOAA. Within days of this grant getting funded, NOAA and the scientists on this crew spent many, many emails going back and forth with the understanding that perhaps we could use our best interests to collect samples if there was a plume where we were around that would best describe the not only the amounts of hydrocarbons, but it's also just even more important, the distribution. Remember that there are many, many compounds that make up oil, and each one of these compounds has a different personality. And when you look at these compounds and their personalities, you can learn a lot about how they behaved. And so what happened was we were able to collect samples with the guidance of Sentry as a hunter, and we collected these water samples, and then we sent them. They only have a 7-day shelf life. They had to be picked up several times during the cruise by work boats. They had to get shipped ashore and then sent out to laboratories that work as part of NOAA's ongoing natural resource damage assessment. It has been an outstanding relationship that we've had with NOAA, and this data has been a big help to us. One thing to keep in mind is that we don't live in a world of the television show CSI. We all want data in 8 seconds, and that's just not going to happen in this world. Patience is a virtue. We have a few data points so far that have come out of the natural resource damage assessment. It is by no means a knock on those laboratories. In fact, it's more of a compliment. It takes a long time to make these measurements, go through a variety of quality control and validation. So I cannot underscore to you the importance that what we have found was some hydrocarbons in the plume. We will know more with time as more data comes out of the pipeline, out of the hundreds of samples that we collected in collaboration with NOAA. And in that time, we'll be able to have a better aspect of how much oil was flowing in this plume at this time. We don't have those answers, and we don't have any ideas to biological activity at this time. And moreover, we collected these samples in June. If you can think about the wellhead, that broken riser pipe is a faucet. The faucet has been shut off. We don't know where these hydrocarbons are. We saw them in June. Our goal was to document a plume and see what its size, shape, distribution, and eventually its chemical composition. This is an important aspect because there's very little known about oil in the subsurface. If you asked me, and I've been studying oil spills for 15 years, whether or not you would see oil in a subsurface, I would say no, doesn't oil float? So this is an important aspect in the basic science world. So I think it's important for us to keep in mind that that this is the first chapter, but it's an important chapter in understanding and recognizing the size and the shape and the distribution and the behavior of this rather surprising phenomena of a plume. And in this case, we were quite rigorous in the definition of our plume. Others have said what a plume is, and I don't discount other findings of plumes, and they may all differ because it's how you define what a plume is. Rich or Dana Yerger can be a little bit more robust in terms of how we defined what a plume was. There was a certain amount of rigor in that respect. At this point, we know the plume exists, and we will know more about its potential biological activity and other aspects in the future. One of the other aspects of this study was to investigate dissolved oxygen. Just like you and I need oxygen to breathe and make a living, so do any self-respecting microbe. Moreover, any self-respecting microbe will want to eat oil. It is like butter, or that's why it gives us fuel. But microbes are a lot like teenagers. They work on their own time, their own scale. They do what they want when they want. And so it's difficult often to make predictions about microbial degradation, and in fact, it may vary substantially in the Gulf at any one time. My colleague, Dr. Ben Van Moy, is going to explain a little bit about how we studied biodegradation, but I just want to underscore to you, this was 2 weeks in June in a relatively small area and a very large part of the body of water. So I'll pass this off to Ben.
Thank you. As Dr. Reddy said, we used oxygen as a proxy for the respiration of hydrocarbons by microbes. It's a a common approach that's been used for quite a while. So obviously when there's an oil spill, one of the first order questions is what is the fate of that oil spill, and are microbes active in degrading the oil? And what we did is we took oxygen measurements through the plume layer that was identified by the Sentry missions. And there were a few cases where we saw that oxygen was drawn down. But for the most part, in the plume layer, the oxygen drawdown was very hard to actually measure. You could say that it was within what we expected from background levels. So what these measurements enabled us to do was to put a limit on what we thought the microbial respiration rate was during our cruise when we were there. And at that point, we made an estimate of about 1 micromole oxygen per day. That rate is considerably faster than you would expect at that depth in any other location, but is also considerably slower than a rate of microbial activity on the surface. And so I just want to emphasize again that these were measurements that we made over the time period while we were there, and they don't necessarily preclude there being some heterogeneity in the response of microbes in this area, and in fact we do see some heterogeneity. But again, the overall result was that we didn't see marked oxygen drawdown in this plume location near the well.
Thanks, Ben. At this point, we'll open up the floor to questions. I'm going to go this side, that side, and then we'll take a telephone question. So, yes, in the back.
Susan Bonner with Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Recently, the government of the United States says that it is confident that its scientific research delivered to it says that there is just, I think, 26% of the oil that cannot be accounted for coming out of that broken well. Does your findings dispel that? Can you comment on that? In layman's terms, please.
Try to. What the government has done and other universities are trying to constrain a budget, just like how we try to balance our checkbook. They're in their first pass. They have done an estimate of what they have done in terms of trying to figure out where the oil has gone. At this point, science is incremental. There are many samples that have not yet been collected, and I don't think that in the near future, I would be surprised if estimates didn't change as more data comes along. The key point is that will our samples help out? Sure, because as more of this data that I said that we're waiting for, it becomes available, then we'll be able to give this data to them and they'll be able to put it into their calculations.
That's what they say. That's what they've told the American people, that 75% of the oil that gushed out of the well is either dispersed or was collected or was burned off.
All I can tell you is that we found a plume, and I can't tell you how much oil was in it because we don't have the values yet. We know there is a plume. We know its length. We know its shape. We know that we collected water samples in it. And when we have analyzed those samples, we'll be able to constrain how much what the inventory of those compounds were in there. And at that point, we may be able to see whether it's a penny in a very big checkbook, I mean, a checking account, or maybe it's bigger. At that point, the key thing right here in this whole oil spill science is we have to balance patience and urgency. And in some cases, I think that patience is a virtue. In other cases, we have to balance with urgency. And at this point, I would say, in our case, I would comment more when I have more analytical data.
Take one from the phone.
In order to ask an audio question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from the line of Elizabeth Grossman with Earth Island Journal.
Yes, thanks so much for taking my question. I think my question would be for Chris Reddy, but anybody else could answer it as well. In the introduction to the call, Dr. Lanier mentioned that NOAA helped coordinate handling of samples so that they would meet requirements, legal requirements of the natural resources damage assessment process. Could somebody explain what that means, please?
I will gladly. In fact, I was the point person on that position. When we had we found out that the cruise was funded, it just so happened to be about the time in which there was a science summit in Louisiana on June 3rd. There was many scientists from a variety of federal agencies, including NOAA. I discussed with many of the key NOAA scientists about the opportunity, how we could collaborate together and with a joint benefits to both. And we did. It takes with a lot of planning on both ends. And what Rob Munier was saying was that unlike most academics, grab a sample, it'll sit in the back of their lab for a few months, and then they'll analyze it some afternoon and maybe forget to shut off the chart recorder. When you handle samples with a natural resource damage assessment, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to collaborate them with my end, is they do it right. It is done to the highest specifications. There is protocol after protocol after protocol. And so, and in fact, one of the aspects was that we needed to get these samples off the boat because they have to be analyzed within 7 days. So we had hanging over our head the challenges of not only collecting samples and deploying Sentry and trying to get Sentry in and out of the water, but in some cases that we had to get these water samples picked up by a smaller boat. So it was at times a logistical challenge, but the end result is that I believe that we collected some really outstanding samples. We present a few data points at this point. With time, as I said before, we will have a lot more samples, perhaps hundreds. And when we do that, we'll be able to fill in the plume, per se, as to think about this oil spewing out of the bottom of the ocean floor, made up of thousands of compounds, and each one of these compounds having a different personality or chemical, physical behavior. You know, the question that's burning a hole in my head every night before I go to bed is, what compounds took a right-hand turn? Who decided they were going to go into the plume and who went up to the surface? I mean, that's a key question in understanding plume formation. And in a couple months, with patients, we will be able to look at the chemicals that were in the plume versus the chemicals that were coming out of the broken riser pipe. And with some good physical chemistry, we will be able to sit down and get a good feeling as to perhaps how the plume formed. And with also that more data, we'll also be able to get an idea as to its inventory and its bioactivity.
Thanks. But just to follow up so that I can describe it correctly, the Natural Resources Damage Assessment requirement is that time frame, that 7-day deadline for getting the samples into analysis, or is there some other legal requirement irrespective of the science questions that are being asked?
The 7-day hold time, is what we call a hold time, is part of a series of chemical methods that have determined that the integrity of a water sample in a certain size vial and a certain size temperature it holds for 7 days. So it must be analyzed in that window.
Okay, so that's really, and the testing protocols, that's what's in the natural resources damage assessment requirements, rather than saying these samples go here, these samples go there, or something else?
No, after they are collected, they're inventoried, they are picked up by a boat, they get to land, and then our collaborators would decide what laboratory they would go to for a more comprehensive analysis.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Christina Ruffini with CBS Evening News. Understanding that you haven't been out and actually seen this plume since June, and this is for whoever wants it, and that your information is limited, do we have any idea what the status, I know conjecture is a dirty word in science, but what the status of this plume might be at this point? Do you think it's stable? Do you think it's staying where it was? And if it's stable and it's staying there, how long is it going to stay there? Is it going to break up? Is it going to move on? What do we think?
We can say that when we measured the plume, it was traveling at a rate of about 6.5 kilometers per day. So that would suggest, you know, based on the water currents there, that the compounds that we measured at that point in time have moved on. As to where they've actually gone, I don't know. We don't have enough information to provide an informed answer there. Given that the well has been capped or shut in now for roughly a month, there should not be any more input to this plume, so effectively the faucet has been turned off. So it's unlikely that you would find the plume still there. Difficult to say.
We have a question from Seth Bornstein. Question from Seth.
Your next question comes from the line of Seth Bornstein with Associated Press.
Thank you so much for doing this. If we're looking at the 1,000 to 1,400 meter depth here, can you? I know you're more chemical oceanographers than biological oceanographers, but can you tell us a little bit about what, given the hydrocarbon signatures you're seeing, what that would mean to marine life in that area, or marine life that travels in the area bringing nutrients from the depth up? In other words, you know, why does the plume there matter? What's the effect on marine life?
Well,
and if Chris, can you do that?
Sure, Seth. How are you?
Hi.
Haven't talked to you in a while. why does it matter is that it's an important understanding about oceanography. We have released oil at 5,000 feet, and we have done a man-made experiment. We would be scientifically negligent if we did not take upon this opportunity to respond to this uninvited guest. So that is the one thing that we have to keep in mind. The question of toxicity is a very difficult field, and it's even more difficult when we only have a limited amount of data about the compounds that exist in the plume. So at this point, what I would say, Seth, is that at this point we know there is a plume, we know there are some hydrocarbons in there, we know that we collected many samples, and with time we'll be able to sit down with toxicologists and ecologists when we have a full data set and see whether or not the extent of the amount and the duration of exposure would be cause any damages.
So, but for now, you really don't know if this would have any effect on the marine life. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Yeah, I feel very comfortable.
Okay, thanks.
Sure, Seth.
Hi, I'm Shauna Thomas with NBC News. And sort of going back to the government's estimates, their oil budget, I heard someone say that the microbes at that level were breaking the oil or the hydrocarbons down slower than at the surface, and that y'all seemed surprised that it was staying level at the 1,100-meter mark. So does this mean that do you think the government has taken these things into account with their oil budget? And if so, does that mean that their estimates may be wrong about breaking the oil breaking down?
I'd like to go back to what this paper is about, which is finding a plume and defining a plume and seeing its size and shape. You know, understanding the budgets of how much and where the oil is was certainly outside the scope in our plans when we wrote this manuscript, and we're certainly not in a position to, we haven't done our homework in that respect, to look at those types of what we call mass balances to see where everything's going. In respect to microbial degradation, you know, all we can say is what we saw at this location. It's quite possibly that the microbes could have gone gangbusters in other places. And the good thing is that there are many samples that have not been analyzed. Microbes eat compounds like we eat at a buffet. They like some compounds better than others. They leave behind a fingerprint of what they chose to eat, and in fact, there's scales of biodegradation. With time, as more samples get analyzed and come out of the pipeline, including the ones that we collected, we'll be able to have a better handle on microbial degradation, probably amongst a lot of the Gulf. But you have to recognize the Gulf is big,
And, you know, we can only sample so much. And so any huge mass balance estimates are certainly not within our interest at this point. We certainly hope that the data that we generate with time as we continue to work on this project will be helpful. But anything in regards to whether it's the NOAA's estimates or the recent estimates from the University of Georgia are outside the purview of this manuscript.
Was the data given over to the government before you released it here? What y'all found about the plume and...
Yeah, go ahead, please.
One thing we should keep in mind is that there are data and there are findings. We've been working very closely with the government to try and give them what we think are what is useful information. But the data by itself, unless you have context for it, is actually not that helpful. So one of the important things, we as scientists, our job is to go and collect this data, but make something useful from it, derive information from it. And so we've been working very closely with the government to provide our findings to help in guiding colleagues elsewhere in terms of how they go about their cruise planning. We have loaned out equipment to these other people and organizations to help with the cleanup process. And I think all of us here on this panel that work as researchers at Woods Hole, we're actually involved on multiple projects, not just this one. So we're very actively trying to help the government agencies as well as the various responders there.
We'll take another call from the phone line.
The next question comes from the line of David Biello with Scientific America.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. To go back to the actual measurements, you define the plume as in the neighborhood of 50 micrograms per liter of BTEX, the benzene, toluene, and the rest of them. How does that compare? And if I'm doing my math right, that's roughly equivalent to 50 ppm. How does that compare to the 4 to 7 ppm that NOAA was putting out? And how much of Louisiana sweet crude is typically composed of BTEX?
Okay, I can answer some of those questions and some of them I cannot. I could give you a semester-long class on how petroleum is formed. I'm not going to do that to you today. But in the process of cooking and squeezing old organic debris, a variety of organic molecules are formed. A very nice study done about 10 years ago had identified that about 1% of crude oil in the region that we were studying would be these six compounds, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, ortho, meta, and para, xylene. And one thing you have to keep reminding is that there are many other compounds. Now look at this little drawing. This is many compounds that exist in the oil. We showed in this paper just a few data points, okay? We collected samples at specific locations with our sensor reconnaissance. They were collected as part of the NOAA, our collaboration with NOAA, and we collected samples for volatile compounds and compounds that are semi-volatile. Think about this, volatile are compounds that might make up gasoline, and compounds that are semi-volatile are larger molecules beyond gasoline. We only looked at a few samples so far, and they were ones that contained benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and the xylenes. By using these as indicators, we were able to cross out natural seeps. But we have not analyzed all the rest of the oil compounds in the samples because we've only looked at a few of the volatile region samples. There's a whole other set of samples for semi-volatile organic compounds. Until we do that, we cannot estimate the total oil in the plume, its biological activity, or even any aspect of how the plume may have formed from a chemical perspective. So the number of 50 micrograms per liter was just a value that we used to help estimate natural seep input, but it certainly does not constrain what the total amount of oil was in that plume. It only sets a minimum. There are many, many more compounds in petroleum. Who decided to take that right-hand turn into the plume and decided to go upward will know more with time.
Hi, my name is Tennille Tracy with Dow Jones. On this point that we're just talking about, we are saying that we can't yet determine how much oil is in this plume, and if I hear you right, we can't say how many plumes are out there in general. Could be handfuls, you know, a dozen, who knows. But the federal government seems to be coming out with pretty specific statistics and pretty specific estimates. So as people tracking this issue, should we be suspicious or wary of those estimates? And as scientists, would you feel comfortable giving that specific of a peg of how much oil has evaporated or disappeared or whatever at this point?
I'd say as a scientist, as scientists, we have to be skeptics. Our requirement is evidence. It's not a matter of belief, it's evidence. So I can only speak for the evidence that we have, and that is that we found a plume. I think we can say that conclusively. We can say conclusively that this plume was stable at 1,100 meters for whatever reason. We're not sure yet why. We know that it does contain certain types of hydrocarbons, but the picture is incomplete at this point. So we don't know if there were other plumes in other areas or if other plumes formed at different times. Like I said at the beginning, this is a synoptic snapshot of the environment back in the middle of June at that site, but we can't infer or extrapolate to other regions or other times.
I like to use this one rule of thumb, which is science is not a house of cards. That means that you know, one piece of data is wrong and then the whole concept, the whole idea falls down. It's much more like a jigsaw puzzle. We fill it in. Sometimes we think a horse is a zebra or a zebra is a horse. We fix it and we move forward. Science is incremental, and at this point we have available information, and as things move forward, we'll learn more and more. And that's actually what makes being a scientist a lot of fun. Not to say that working on a disaster is fun, but you know, that's what science is about. Do you want to add, David? Oh, okay. You're more welcome.
We can take a call.
Your next question comes from the line of Dan Vergano with USA Today.
Thanks very much for doing this. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what maybe is going on deep in the ocean that could concentrate the plume this way. I know you said you don't have any answers, but and you're surprised that oil didn't float, but what's going on in there? Is this just a physical effect of current and pressure, or is there some chemistry, or what do you think is happening?
If you go to the literature, there was an experiment that was done in about 10 years ago off of Norway, where there was a artificial leak created at, I think it was 800 meters depth. And one thing about that experiment was that it was carried out for a period of only 2 hours. They released oil and gas at 800 meters depth and watched to see what would happen. And they found evidence of a trapped plume, as they called it, setting up in the subsurface. But the release wasn't carried on long enough for a steady state condition to set up. So it was transient, and you can go read about it. That was where a starting point was for us in trying to analyze what was going on and construct our mission plan. If you go back even earlier, back to 1979 with the Ixtoc blowout, there were hydrocarbons that were tracked in the subsurface 40 kilometers downrange. And one of these compounds in particular, benzene, that's the B in BTEX. They were able to track it 40 kilometers downrange despite that well only being 50 meters deep. Now, to put that in context, the Deepwater Horizon or Macondo well is 30 times deeper. So it would suggest that there maybe is more opportunity for these plumes to set up. We don't know the process. Nobody goes out and just releases oil at this depth without some very good reasons to do so. So it's something that's difficult to model, and there are many potential factors that we just don't know enough about. One is that at these depths, the depth of the plume at 1,100 meters, it's well below the hydrate stability zone. So theoretically, the light hydrocarbons, methane through pentane, should form gas hydrates. Now, in addition, there was there were dispersants that were used at the blowout preventer, and those may play a role in plume formation. We don't know. Also, just the pressure and temperature regime at those depths caused the chemicals to behave, or the hydrocarbons to behave differently. Sometimes you get phase changes. There's a term, condensate, that's used in the oil and gas industry. That refers to when you have a light hydrocarbon that's normally in gas form. By manipulating the pressure and temperature, you can actually have it become a liquid, like you would have, for example, in your average barbecue tank that's full of propane. So there are these very complex dynamics that are thought to go on, and we just don't know how the interplay works between them.
Hi, Devin Powell from Inside Science. So in May, researchers at UGA and USF identified the 30% drop in oxygen that they were looking at, and you guys seem here to have not found this sort of sudden drop. It was used at the time to warn that perhaps there might be the possibility of dead zones forming around these plumes. Does this then suggest necessarily that those were wrong? Is the lesson that those sensors weren't operating properly or reliable, or is the lesson that different snapshots at different places and different times can reveal different pictures?
I think maybe I can start this off on the technological side and then hand off to Ben. In terms of oxygen measurements, there's a technology that's common in oceanography for measuring oxygen. They're what are called sometimes Clark electrodes or microelectrodes. They're used to measure oxygen. Unfortunately, these types of sensors are sensitive to oil. There's a cross sensitivity. So if a sensor, one of these detectors, is exposed to oil or becomes fouled with oil, it'll cause the sensor to have erroneously low oxygen readings. That's well documented. As a matter of fact, you can go back to technical notes on some of these sensors back 10 years, and they describe that. So that's something that is a cautionary with any sensor. You can't treat it as a black box where it always gives you the right answer. So during our cruise, Ben Van Mooy did Winkler titrations in parallel. Winkler titrations, it's wet chemistry where you take a water sample and physically titrate and get an oxygen value determined that way. It's labor-intensive, but it's the gold standard. It's been around since 1888, and it's very well understood. So, and with that, Ben, if you want to describe a little more.
Yes, the data we collected, the comparison between the Winkler and the electrode, seemed to indicate that at least the electrode that we had, there was some discrepancy. We didn't see some of the low oxygen values that were given by the microelectrode. Those were not borne out in some cases by the Winkler titration.
But that doesn't mean that other people's sensors weren't working, you know, perfectly well. Obviously, there is this caveat of a well-known issue where hydrocarbons could cause that sensor to not work properly. But again, you know, it's. I think maybe the take-home is that the Gulf is a very and this problem is a problem that has the potential to be patchy, and I think that different techniques may return different answers in different locations. And I think it kind of points to the fact that this when you go at a problem that's this big, it's important to bring to the table many different scientific techniques. And we actually measured oxygen three different ways that are presented in this paper. We use a microelectrode, we use the Winkler, and then we use the data from the mass spectrometer. And in this case, the mass spectrometer and the Winkler agreed very well. And actually, the microelectrode agreed fairly well most of the time, too. But in some cases, the microelectrode didn't. And so that's kind of the advantage when you bring a number of tools to attack one particular parameter, is that you get to get this perspective. So I definitely can't say firsthand about what other investigators are finding, and I certainly can't pin microelectro problems exclusively as explaining their results. But it is a possibility, and it's something that we found in our sensor to a limited degree.
But as a rule of thumb, if you are interested in dissolved oxygen in the ocean, you generally always bring the Winkler titration set up. If you are interested in oxygen, if you're a person of that research area, that would be like telling a carpenter to measure twice and cut once. So whether or not these electrodes worked well or were not working well, you cannot rely on electrode sensors in oiled areas, and that's why you'd want backups. As the manufacturer of these electrodes had said, not only in a 2001 technical note, but in a February 2010 technical note. So the, trying to measure oxygen only by these electrodes may cause a false reading, but it depends on the manufacturer and the type of the sample. But often if you are in the business of looking at oxygen, you usually bring a Winkle with you. It's prison work, but you got to do it.
We can take a call.
Your next question comes from the line of Deborah Zabarenko with Reuters News.
Hi there, and like everyone else, thanks for doing this call. All the smart questions may have been asked, so I'll ask a simple one. First, I want to be sure that we don't know the answer to the question, how fast are the hydrocarbons in the plume degrading? So that's one. And the other one is very simple, which is, what does this section of the plume that you looked at look like? The written statement says it doesn't look like a river of chocolate syrup, but how does it appear?
I can't remember the first question, but I happen to have I collected most of the water samples along with representatives from NOAA, British Petroleum, and the EPA. The water samples, when we were in the right in the plume, looked like spring water, and you certainly didn't see any oil droplets, and you certainly didn't smell it. But that doesn't mean that there's no detectable oil. In terms of the physical three-dimensional shape, we certainly can get this. I don't know if you can see the screen, but certainly watch this video to give you an idea of how it looks in three-dimensional space. Dana, do you want to add anything about
what in terms of
the shape?
Oh, the shape of the plume?
Yeah.
Well, I would just like to add that, you know, the boundaries of that were rigorously defined based on the noise levels of the sensor. So what you're really seeing there is the physical limits side to side in a long track that we have confidence in our sensor to say, yes, there's an anomalous level of hydrocarbon there. So that was rigorously defined, and that's how that picture was generated.
Yeah, maybe I can add a little bit to that without getting too far down into the weeds. we used a statistical method where we defined a plume as a discrete physical area where the hydrocarbon concentrations were more than two standard deviations above the baseline variability in the hydrocarbon concentrations, which basically, to distill that down to English, means we have a 95% confidence that the plume that we described there actually did have anomalously high hydrocarbons in it and was different from the background. Now, we constrained that in the horizontal as well as the vertical. And you'll notice in this animation that it shows the plume not quite starting at the well site or where the brown vertical plume is. And the reason for that is because we could not bring the AUV to closer than, I think it was 5 kilometers radius from the actual well site. The reason for that is that there were many, many ships there, I think on the order of 50 or 80 ships within a couple of square miles. The place looked like Midtown Manhattan with the drill rigs, the ships, the skimmers, all of that sort of thing. Then they had the many, many ROVs, literally a fleet or a couple of fleets of ROVs working on the well site at depth. So there are acoustic communications that can kind of step on each other's toes. So we had to stand off roughly 5 kilometers from the well site where we started the run. And I'd like to point out, this is a credit to the Sentry team. We were able to, they were able to operate this vehicle underneath many ships and know exactly where the vehicle was at all times, and it did exactly as it was commanded to do. And in certain cases, we were able to use what we might call a dynamic retasking capability, that where Dana and his team were able to redirect the vehicle on the fly based on the chemical measurements that were being made. And that was, again, getting back to this issue of basic research helping in an applied situation. Those techniques were developed through a NASA-funded research program. And Dana, I don't know if you want to explain a little bit about that.
Yes. NSF was the primary sponsor of this vehicle, along with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. We also have been receiving some very critical funds from NASA under their ASTEP program, which is focused on searching for life other places in the solar system. And we had the good fortune last fall to do a cruise with NSF and with that ASTEP funding to work on the natural oil and gas seeps off Santa Barbara and Santa Monica, using Rich's Tethys mass spectrometer on Sentry. And little did we know at the time, but that was really a practice run for this expedition, working on this oil spill. So when this opportunity came up, we had the technology in place. But it's not just a matter of technology. It's also a matter of skilled people. It's a matter of relationships between scientists and engineers. People have confidence and trust that you're going to go off on this very expensive endeavor and that you're going to come back with good results. So we had all that in place due to this previous effort, and I think that's part of why we were able to confidently propose this and get it funded in 2 days.
Elizabeth Lee with Voice America. You had reported that the deep sea microbes were degrading this plume relatively slowly. Any idea if the microbes up on the surface would be eating it faster because of either the various chemicals or the depth? And secondly, has there been discussion in the scientific community about a concern that because of all this food that the microbes would have a population explosion, and would that affect the food chain? And then the second question is, any plans for a future expedition We're collecting more samples to see if there's another plume, or if you could talk about that.
I can address some of those. I might punt some of my friends here. Microbes are opportunistic. Any self-respecting microbe is going to take a hit on a petroleum hydrocarbon if the conditions are right. And it's really tricky. I mean, I can't underscore to you that you can predict when sun's going to set, right? You can predict a lot of things. Telling a microbe what to do is like trying to push a teenager around. It is really hard, you know. Sometimes they kick in, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they do the easiest work, they don't do the hard work. It's really hard. It's easy to generalize and say microbes are going to clean house and we can walk away. What I would say is that microbes are a tool in the toolbox of nature's cleanup team. Where and when they turn on and decide to do a good job will probably play out with time. There's certainly some estimates and some rule of thumbs that are in the literature that are probably being used, but there are many samples that are collected, and like I said before, microbes are pretty selective in how they eat oil. And with time, you'll start to see these microbial degradation fingerprints. Do you want to talk a little bit about temperature, Ben?
Oh, sure. With respect to the comparison between the surface and the deep, microbes are, simple organisms. They're, for lack of a better word, they're cold-blooded. And so that means that they, they operate, their metabolism is dictated by the temperature of their surroundings. So if everything else were equal, same bugs, same oil, same nutrients, same oxygen, we would expect that the bugs, the bacteria, in the deep waters would be about 10 times slower just because it's cooler. Obviously, there's a range there, but this is a problem that's been studied extensively in the laboratory, and there have been estimates that have been made about the temperature dependence of oil degradation. So just temperature alone would slow those organisms down. So, and on the other side, I also made a lot of measurements of respiration in the surface waters, and so those data will be forthcoming hopefully fairly soon.
I'll follow up with the answer to the question of plans on additional work. Several of my colleagues here have been on with me on the team doing the flow rate measurements, the initial flow rate measurements, and that work is now fairly well wrapped up. But we've been working in the Gulf for quite a while, not just this expedition, but I think this is where, as citizen scientists, we're trying to be as helpful as we can. And Chris and I have made several trips to the Gulf to lend a hand wherever we can. So if there is an opportunity, I know, I'll just speak for myself, I'll be glad to go back and do what I can.
We're running long, so we're going to take three more calls from the phone and one more from the room, and then wrap it up. So one phone call, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Al Saylor with KZMR.
KZMR-FM. I am curious about your definition of plume. Someone mentioned that there are different ways to define it. Could you tell us how some of the different ways?
Different ways to define a plume. Well, one way is if you just encounter a layer at a particular depth, you might call that a plume. There are any number of ways that you could define a plume. You can do it by proxy measurements chemically and just say it's a different color. You could do it based on, density of the water, any number of ways. But the way that we chose to do it was by directly measuring hydrocarbons in the water and then constraining these anomalies spatially on all three axes, X, Y, and Z, and then describing that based on these concentration distributions.
So,
I mean, I think what Rich is trying to—well, no, not trying. I'm the one scientist plume is not perhaps another scientist plume. It just—it's what you choose to define it as. We define our plume one way. There is no standard oil plume definition because this field is so new. I suspect over time, a variety of scientists have put forth, and there are a variety of other data out there about what is a plume, and we'll have to look at them over time and see how they all compare.
We got a question in the back here.
You mentioned briefly the connection or the potential connection of dispersants potentially having an impact on plume formation. Can you explain what that potential might be, how dispersants affect plume formation? Potentially?
We don't know. I mean, there is a stack of literature about the usage of dispersants as high as my waist and books about oil spill dispersants. I've been on the record with two congressional testimonies that the usage of dispersants on the surface of the ocean was a wise and smart move. It helped overall reduce damages, which is the ultimate goal in the response of any oil spill. The experienced people who make those decisions had an opportunity to do something else, which is to inject dispersants below the surface. There is no literature, no knowledge out there about that, but these are the scientists who have been responding to oil spills since the Exxon Valdez oil spills that don't make CNN, and they decided to do that. At this point, we don't know whether that was a positive or a negative idea. I suspect there will be a lot of data that will come out of this. There might have to be some small scales of somebody making a little oil plume and injecting dispersants. But at this point, it's really hard to know what a dispersant is going to do chemically and how it may affect a plume. We do know that the Norwegian experiment that likely only lasted 2 hours did create a plume without any dispersant.
We'll go back to the phone.
Your next question comes from the line of Brendan Keane, with Wired.
Thank you. you had said that the microbes were, you would expect microbes to be about 10 times less active at depth than on the surface. Does that mean then that the microbial activity you measured is even slower than that factor of 10 that you expected to find? And if not, can you put a layman's figure on the difference between the rules of thumb that you went in with and what you found?
Just to clarify my answer previously, I was strictly talking about just the function of temperature. So I wasn't talking about an absolute rate and making a prediction or extending a rate that we saw in one environment, one in temperature, and then extending that rate or making a prediction on an absolute scale of what that rate might be based on temperature. So back to the point I made earlier, and this is something that's well established in the field of microbiology, is that everything else being equal, microbes are slower when it's colder. And that's the point that I made earlier. The other point, though, that I want to make is that we did make in the paper an estimate with absolute terms. It was a constraint we made on it. And if that rate is ultimately borne out, that rate is actually fairly fast compared to what you would expect. If there weren't an oil spill, or maybe we were out in the middle of the North Pacific Ocean and we went down to 1,100 meters and tried to measure respiration, it would be virtually impossible because the rates are very slow. Some folks are making some headway in that area. So there's kind of a perspective. The rates that we measured, and again, it's just while we were there, location, very important. And at that time, those rates were higher than we probably would have expected. But again, I'm a little bit hesitant to say specifically or to extrapolate the rates we saw to any other environment. And I'm sure, there are a lot of studies that are going on now by other investigators looking at oil degradation on beaches, looking at oil degradation in the surface waters. And I think there's going to be, you're not going to need my response on this question for very much longer. I'm sure there's a lot of very good information on those rates that's going to be coming out shortly.
Okay, we have two quick questions, one from the Times-Picayune and one from the Cape Cod Times.
Mark Schlesstein with the Times-Picayune.
This is Mark Schlesstein with the Times-Picayune. Let me sort of bring this back around to people a little bit, if I could. For shrimpers who are out in the Gulf of Mexico now, or actually inshore waters in Louisiana, what does this study bring to them, if anything? And the other category would be people in restaurants around the United States who are worrying about oil in their fish. How does this help them understand what's going on in terms of research on the effects of this oil spill?
You know, our goal of this study was to investigate plumes. We certainly, our goal wasn't specifically to study toxicity. You have to remember we studied and identified this plume. We're interested about whether or not, why doesn't oil go all the way up to the surface? As much as I would like to help the people of Louisiana and give them information about things so close to their livelihood, I can't say any more than we looked at a plume that was going in the southwest in the last 2 weeks of June. How that equates to the fishery at this time, I can't say anything about that. That's it.
If I can follow up with that, one of the most important aspects of this is to document that these plumes do exist. It's possible for them to form. Initially, the idea of subsurface plumes was tended to be discounted in the media, and what we've been able to do is document using a fairly rigorous approach that not only that a plume did exist, but it was stable at a particular depth interval, and that it was not produced by natural seeps. That was the other thing. People said, well, if there are plumes down there, well, maybe they're caused by natural seeps. We were very confident that this was not caused by a natural seep. And in order to understand these other ecological implications, we have to first establish the base case, plume or no plume. So.
Next call.
Your next question comes from the line of Susan Milton with the Cape Cod Times.
Hi, Susan Milton from the Cape Cod Times. I just wanted to check something you said earlier. As I heard, you weren't able to finish mapping the length of the plume because of the pending arrival of Hurricane Alex. Is that so?
That's correct.
That was easy.
We have time for one last comment from the room.
Yeah. Let me introduce you to Dr. Steve Morawski. He is with NOAA and has been one of the lead scientists with the government on the oil spill. We're pleased to have him here in the audience, and I think he's going to make the last response.
Thanks, Dr. Reddy. I want to express our sincere thanks to the whole team at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and to the National Science Foundation, not only for this project, but for their continued involvement in the spill. The involvement is very widespread. When we asked the President, Susan, to be involved in manning some of the operations, they were right there. These results are important in their own right, but they also have informed the National Incident Command. As Dr. Camilli said, the data were shared almost immediately with the Incident Command that allowed us to vector other ships around and to confirm and be confirmed by some of these results. As well, the oil samples that are in the NERDA process will be a major part of a case if it develops against the responsible party. And I just can't tell you enough how important the collegial relationship with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution has been and will be. And we really appreciate the opportunity not only to be informed by the data, but to operate as colleagues in this event. And this is an ongoing event, both in terms of the analysis of the data and the sampling that's ongoing. So much appreciate that from both NOAA's point of view as well as the Incident Command. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry, my name is Steve Morawski.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. You may disconnect your lines at this time.